America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. It's a subject Americans like to avoid, and one that it's said the average person can only handle psychologically for about 15 minutes at a time when it relates to them. The subject is death. On this podcast, we explore the fast-changing approaches to dying and funereal practices. There are new rituals, often more personalized than in the past. The whole approach to honoring, memorializing, and remembering a life well lived is evolving as Americans shed religious traditions that previously made ritual more standard. It's a perfect, but nonetheless difficult topic here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Shannon Lee Dadu, and she's written a book called American Afterlives, Reinventing Death in the 21st Century. And it's interesting, at the beginning of your book, and by the way, there are many images by Daniel Zox, so I want to reference that, and you can talk about the overall project that you're doing with Daniel. But I just wanted to ask, I mean, you said at the beginning that your books continually get, well, more curious or odd as you go along. Was this an odd topic to tackle?
Yeah, I don't think it was the topic so much as the way I approached it, which was simultaneously academic. I had anthropological questions, archaeological questions about what's happening with death in the U.S. today, but it was also very personal. I didn't feel like I could write a book like this without talking about my own experiences with death. I didn't want to feel like I was exploiting people's sensitivities around death, and I wanted to put myself on the same plane as others who've experienced loss or who have fears about death.
Mm-hmm. Now, you indicate that you've had a lot of losses in the recent period. How important was that for you to be able to excavate a topic like this?
I think it was very important. I open each chapter with a personal experience, just very briefly. The whole book is not about me. I'm actually very uncomfortable being the center of attention, but it felt like an ethical commitment that I needed to do that. But I became aware of all the changes that are happening in American death through the experience of, you know, helping family to arrange memorials, witnessing and attending, receiving gifts of keepsakes, things like that.
Well, when we go back, I mean, you state, and I did another podcast on this topic before with a scholar. He wrote a book called Is the Cemetery Dead? And we were talking about a whole range of changes that have been taking place, and you approach it from a different angle. But clearly, the death industry, if we want to call it that, because we did professionalize the care and the transport of bodies and the way that they were handled and the rituals in about the same way for many, many years. And now that is just really exploding as it relates to change in this particular area.
As you point out, the way that things are changing are in so many different directions, it can be a little disorienting. I guess I would, first of all, point to two paths. One is how professional, traditional funeral directors are changing. They're realizing they used to present a traditional package of the embalmed body, the fancy casket, and the concrete vault. As I did my research, I started to realize that it was actually a really unique, internationally speaking, across the world, anthropologically speaking, when you compare it to other cultures, a really unique death ritual. And what was also peculiar about it is that despite the U.S.'s incredible diversity, ethnic and religious, regional, that by the mid-20th century, this complex, this funeral rite had become 95% of the death dispositions and rituals that we did. So it was a national ritual that overarched all of our internal diversity, which was fascinating to start with. But now that's changing. And one of the things that funeral directors have realized is that people don't want this anymore. They used to be considered leaders, almost like ministers, who you go to in times of trouble and you just trust them to give mm-hmm. you the reassuring, familiar tradition. Now people are not reassured by this tradition. They're actually more and more a little uncomfortable, and maybe even creeped out by the embalmed body. They also have a perspective that's kind of curious that it's a waste of money and a waste of space to do things that way. So funeral directors are being forced to realize they need, if they're going to stay in business, they need to give their clients, their families, what they want. So there's response on that side, on the professional side. On the other side, there's a whole lot of deprofessionalization going on. People are taking their loved ones back home, having home funerals. They're taking the cremation ashes and making up their own rituals. They're saying, I don't need a ritual specialist. I can do this myself. And I kind of call this the rugged individualism.
Why do you think America is starting to reflect this way? In other words, sometimes when we hand something off to a professional, we think, you know, this is their sphere, and why should I get involved? What's going on, do you think, psychologically with the American public really wanting, because there are some, and I know you have differing views in the book about whether Americans really want to deny death, period, and we're a culture that looks at youth and vitality with a great deal of passion, and we want to hold on to it, and we try to keep ourselves young, and we've got all of these miracle, you know, cures for everything, and suggesting that we can extend life. What's happening here, as you see it, with the American public?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that maybe made my study a little different is, in an odd way, I wasn't just interested in death. I was interested in looking at death practices the way an archaeologist does, which is that death practices tell us something about the values and beliefs of a society. So they're a window into things that sometimes aren't even all that well expressed about what's going on with a culture and a society. And so all this foment, all this change indicates that we're a society undergoing tremendous amount of change in our beliefs and values. Some of this has to do with getting away from organized religion, but I believe others have to do with at the national level. Our 20th century pattern was a national ritual that united us across religious differences. So it was never really theologically driven, our death ritual, the American death ritual. Mm-hmm. What's significant to me is that things were changing slowly. There were critiques of the well-known critiques that started in the 1960s of the traditional American funeral complex and the industry. And people were slowly moving towards cremation, but not anything like they were in, say, the UK or Europe or other industrialized countries. Pretty slowly, until 9/11. And then the rate, you can track this on a map, you know, on a chart, the rate just shoots up astronomically, and it's now exceeded projections, soon to be 70%. I think, you know, President Biden in his inauguration speech talked about inflection points in American history. I think that that was an inflection point in American death practices and how the living relate to the dead. Instead of being death-denying in the 20th century, what I think we were actually doing was we were being grief-denying. Mm. We were not denying that death happened, or grief-suppressing, shall we say. we live in a very violent society. In fact, there's a kind of death acceptance that, well, you just have a certain number of casualties in war, you know, because of gun rights, you know, and now because of COVID, right? There's this peculiar acceptance of the fact of death that other societies, industrial societies, really do not, you know, they try to keep everybody alive. It's actually a very, very important value. You know, somewhat controversially, I would say the evidence to me shows that it's not an important American value. Life itself is not valued that much, not adult life. What I think happened is we were not allowed to grieve for long or in public. You're supposed to move on, get back to work. We also comparatively have incredibly tight-fisted, ungenerous bereavement policy in this country. You know, people talk about parental leave. It's also about bereavement leave. Most people who work for wages rather than salary don't have any at all. Their mother dies, their wife dies. They can't take time off work except to lose money. And even the salary, it's like 3 days, which is only enough to fly across the country and come back, not to recover. So, and I think this is indicative, again, that grieving was not allowed. But with 9/11, if you remember, there were all of those public memorials, the chain link fences, lined visibly with people's photos and with mementos, and it was televised. The event of death itself was televised, and it was basically like a mass cremation event. Like, you could no longer deny what was happening, the way that it was became a national event of trauma and of mourning. You know, and we've had things that led up to this, like roadside shrines and celebrity deaths, where people will leave these spontaneous shrines on the sidewalk. But nothing in which everyone participated on some emotional level. So I really think that was...
Yeah, but let me get back to that, because it's such an interesting thing that you bring up. I mean, you go back to 1960, only 4% of Americans who died were cremated. Then, of course, you know, it started going up, as you say, but very incrementally. And we're now, I think, at 60%. But you really think that 9/11 was that seminal in all of this? Because there are others who are suggesting that the cost of that burial approach that you talked about earlier, the professionalization, finally got to people. And then, of course, the whole idea that in suburbs we're not building cemeteries because they are wasteful of a lot of precious space for the living. And so the question is there a combination of factors at work here?
Absolutely, I would say there's a combination of factors, but let me touch on how I'm a contrarian with several of these commonly cited economic explanations. Number one, the traditional funeral is actually, the scheme of things, not that expensive at all. The average funeral, the whole thing, you know, preparing the body, doing the legal work, transporting the body, having a nice casket, putting it in the ground, having a stone, forever. The average cost is around $10,000 in today's dollars. In the average American wedding is $30,000. So, and you know, anthropologists call these rites of passage. Around the world, when the human being transitions from one role in society and one relationship to the group to another, these are major rituals, major events. So naming or christening ceremonies when a child looks like it's going to survive infancy, puberty rites, we're talking quinceañeras or bar mitzvahs or any other kind of the prom. These are very important. Weddings. And of course, now you can have more than one wedding. You can only have one funeral. And around the world, this final rite of passage, this final ritual that mediates the relationship between an individual and the group, is considered the most important. It's often a case of expenditure and of generosity. The weird thing that I think has happened is that we identify the individual with the consumer for in such an intense way in American society,
mm-hmm.
that we misidentify that the person who the spending is being lavished on, even though it's really not that much money, is the dead person. That's not true. That ritual is for the survivors. And so this is a major misunderstanding, as if the dead person is a consumer. The waste of space issue is a complete red herring. There is no shortage of cemetery space in the United States, with the exception of a couple of inner city, urban, very old cemeteries. I can count them on two hands in the entire country. So I think a more valid point that I think adds to the factors of why things are changing is how mobile a society we are. Generation after generation, we're about, and my family's, I exemplify this, are moving thousands and thousands of miles away from their hometowns. They're uprooted. They don't associate with their hometowns and their hometown, and therefore their hometown cemeteries. So I think that's an important factor to what.
Yeah, that's really key. And of course, as you said about organized religion having kind of less sway today with so many individuals. When you look at it, writing a book like this, you said toward the end was when the pandemic was raging. You know, my daughter was in Washington recently, and to your point about America getting inured to death, there was an exhibition right in front of, the Smithsonian, and it had all the flags, white flags, for the mm-hmm. people who had died during the pandemic here in the United States. And then there was an area that was offset from this, and it had, I think, 25 white flags. I may be getting this wrong, but something like that. And it was representative of what New Zealand had lost during the same pandemic. And it talked about all the things they did to preserve life. So when you look at America's response to the pandemic, now I know you're an anthropologist, an archaeologist, so you like to step back, and I'm asking you to get in the middle of something ongoing. What does it say?
It says, I think, that we're a death-accepting society. And it, you know, one of the things I stumbled upon is that I have some colleagues who practice what they call existential anthropology, where they take existential philosophy and combine it with an anthropological view. And some people argue that some cultures are more existential in its simplest meaning, accepting the facts of death and to live life knowing that there will be an ending. And what I have witnessed, and we all have witnessed with the COVID-19 pandemic, I think is an indicator that contemporary U.S. society is a particularly existential one. Now, you can have a positive response to accepting the fact of death, or you can have a very negative one. And I think part of it is, are you willingly accepting the death of others, or willingly accepting your own death?
Shannon Lee Dottie is with us. The book is called American Afterlives, Reinventing Death in the 21st Century. You tell us that death is being reinvented on three levels simultaneously: the disposing of the human remains, new rituals, and people are designing their own ways, many memorials, many using social media, as you talked about, people being dispersed, and then ideas about the afterlife. Are Americans really getting more contemplative? Because you talk about a juxtaposition between the materialistic and the spiritual in some combination. And in America, we understand our material side. It's everywhere. But what about the juxtaposition with the spiritual?
This was one of the really interesting and I would say more heartening things I discovered through this journey. And that is that, yes, there is a lot of active entrepreneurialism. People have not just traditional funeral directors, but other sorts of inventors, designers, business entrepreneurs have recognized that there's a demand out there for different kinds of death rituals, different things to do with the body, and they're responding very actively and transforming the field from human composting to taking cremated remains and making things like diamond jewelry, glass artwork, paintings that are made with human remains and a portrait of the individual, all kinds of things. And people are making a little bit of profit off of it. I haven't seen that people are making a huge amount of money, but, you know, these are successful businesses. They're responding to a need, a desire for new kinds of ritual and a new kind of relationship between the living and the dead, where it's okay not so much to keep grieving, but it's okay to keep relating to the dead, to celebrate their birthday, to have some piece of them with you so that you can talk to them, remember them, have them there on important occasions. One of the things that's so fascinating to me about this is that it harkens back to the 19th century American spiritualist movement and beliefs in ghosts. A lot of the people I talk to about these new kinds of memorial activities and memorial objects sincerely believe in ghosts. And so what they want, about 40, there's a Pew Charitable Trust survey that showed that 45% of Americans believe in ghosts. Only 50% identify with organized religion. So we're getting close to half these here. I sincerely think that a lot of these practices have to do with facilitating an ongoing communication with the other world, with the people in the afterlife. Not everyone does it for those reasons, but enough do that I think that's one of the reasons it's taking off.
You say that contemporary American death culture might be confusing in its innovation and pluralism, but not boring. I mean, how creative are we getting? I mean, Americans like to be creative in music, in the arts, and we export a lot of that. Are some of the new practices that are going on in America really leading a movement, a trend across the world? Are we ahead? Are we behind? Because you talk about mixing your loved one's ashes into a vinyl record that plays a recording of their voice. I mean, a whole range of things that I guess in the past some might have considered maudlin, but today really people are embracing that. And does it say anything about how we're sharing our feelings with people and emotions while they're here? Or is it remorseful that we didn't do more while they were here because we were too busy as Americans working? I know I'm putting a lot on the table here, but.
Yeah, I mean, let me first address that, the relationship of U.S., what's happening in the U.S. versus the world. There are some practices that are definitely being picked up elsewhere. We are definitely, though, the leaders of things. So like human diamonds made from trace amounts of carbon from the cremated ash through a synthetic process. They're real diamonds, but they're made through this complicated process. We're the U.S. is the absolute leading market of that, but it is starting to be popular in Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan. Things like the vinyl record are popular in the U.K. There are, in terms of creativity, one of the things that I also came to realize is that designers and artists are leading the field. And even if they intended to shock at first, or just shock in the sense of creating a piece of art that starts a conversation about death, which what they're finding is that people are starting to think of their singular artworks as a prototype for a product. People want more of what they thought was a unique thing. So, for example, I interviewed a lady who has a gallery in California where she collects one-of-a-kind art pieces created by artists around the world, but mostly in the U.S., of urns and things to do with ashes. She has one that was one of my favorites that an artist developed that's a bubblegum machine of the old kind where you get a plastic bubble with something in it. It may not be bubblegum. Maybe it was a toy. You know, those little dispensers, but it's shaped itself like a bubble. And the idea is that you put cremated remains in each of those, and as long as somebody has a quarter, they can take that home with them. And that kind of distributed remains, where everybody gets a little piece of Uncle Joe, as she said, is also becoming very popular, and you can do with it what you will. There's this understanding that a sacred act in terms of honoring the dead has to be totally unique and individual. So it's also about your unique relationship to that person. So there's a privacy about it, and a respect for innovation that I think goes pretty deep. And I think that there's also a generational split, where for younger folks, there's a little bit more of an openness to doing different things with the body, just like we, there's a generational gap in who gets tattoos and piercings. And I think this is extending to the body. How we express things with our body and with the human remains is much more open to individual creativity. So I think there are world patterns to some degree that both our laws in the U.S. allow for kind of the maximum creativity on the one hand. And on the other hand, I think that the hyper-individualism that is American ideology is also encouraging this fluorescence of ritual activity and DIY practices.
What about the scholarship surrounding this? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you, of course, others, of course, Atul Gawande, who talked about being mortal. And so we're reading more about death. Another trend is, of course, that people are going to these death cafes. I did a podcast on that a couple of years ago. And social media, sharing. I just read something that was on the anniversary of someone's mother's death. And I was so inspired because of something he said about her that I took it and wrote a song, not based upon her because I didn't know her that well, but it inspired me to think about a vein of emotion that I perhaps would not have stumbled upon without reading that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you point out importantly that social media has a lot to do with this. We were talking back about 9/11 being an inflection point. That's around the same time that the internet is becoming more and more predominant. And one of the early uses of new technologies often is around death or whatever is, or porn, whatever is taboo, is often one of the first uses of technology. And that happened with the internet. People, I think, sensed in some sense that they wanted to break the death taboo, which is not about death acceptance. It's about grief. Maybe we should better call it the grief taboo. And so very early on, Facebook in particular, there have been Facebook memorials. Also back in MySpace, there was as well. And there's quite a bit of scholarship at this point tracking this as a new trend, and I do think it affects overall. It's just opened things up where we can talk about death and grief in a way that maybe Kubler-Ross wanted us to accept, but didn't get as much traction as it has now. And this is definitely an aspect. I didn't touch on that as much because as an archaeologist, I wanted to focus on the materiality and to look at how people behave with objects and how they express themselves through their relationship to objects and to the landscape. But it's all, you know, it all goes in together for sure.
Well, you did ask a couple of probing questions of people. And by the way, this is a book and a documentary project, and you can reference that at the end of our conversation. But you ask people, what do you want done with your body when you die? What do you think happens to us after we die? How interesting was that in terms of the response?
The way I documented the interviews and the experience I had over 5 years of researching this book all over the United States, from Vermont to Chicago, New Orleans, Memphis, up and down California. The way I documented interviews and visits to cemeteries and visits to funeral homes was with my collaborator, Daniel Zox, who's an amazing cinematographer. We had become friends, and I had wanted to do a project like this, and at some point I realized this would make a great film. I'm going to be talking to interesting people, and that's very visual. And I also became very intrigued because I wanted to focus on materiality to capture those materials visually rather than to convert everything to words immediately, which in some ways I think shuts down a little bit of what our nonverbal relationship is to one another and to the world. But in a film, you're able to pause and contemplate on that. That is a very important part, and I narrate that, and I talk about making the film. In the end, the film focused on a 20-minute documentary called I Like Dirt, which is focused on California in particular, which is where I grew up, and it's also considered by many people often to be the vanguard of death practices. But the questions evolved because for a long time I lived half in Chicago and half in New Orleans as an adult because of my previous research in New Orleans. And I wanted to start getting comfortable. I was inexperienced as a documentary filmmaker, and I was going to be doing the interviews. He was going to be doing the filming with somebody else helping with the sound. And I just wanted to practice working with the camera and practice my interview skills. We were in New Orleans, and it was Halloween, or it was about to be Halloween. I thought, well, why don't we just go down to the French Quarter and do like man, woman on the street interviews? You know, no stakes, isn't really about the project. You know, I'll get my skills honed. And we went down, and of course it wasn't man on the street. It was zombie on the street. It was vampire on the street. It was ghost on the street, which of course is all about death, right? And our fear of death and our humorous take on death, which is humor is a really important part of the book too. If we're accepting of grief, we're also accepting of laughing about our losses, laughing about our loved one, laughing about our own death. That's the healthy existential adjustment. Anyway, I came up with these questions to ask these random people, and it was moving, it was hilarious, it was surprising. Those two questions, what do you want done with your body, and what do you think happens to us after we die? And because people are in costume as zombies, as ghosts, as scary things, as skeletons, it didn't seem like a strange question, and they were in the mood, but not all the answers were flipped. Some people had recent losses, and they took it very seriously. Another one that sticks out for me is a guy dressed as a zombie who got all serious and said, I think that embalming, I'm going to paraphrase here, but I think embalming the dead body is the most disgusting, horrible thing that people ever came up with. And of course, zombies, by definition, are not embalmed because they're decaying. I also, when I started to interview professional funeral directors who do the traditional work, but who have perspective on how the industry is changing, and on entrepreneurs who are really kind of pushing the envelope of what's possible in terms of memorialization, I decided to end all the interviews to put everyone on a level playing field with those questions. And sometimes the professionals weren't any better prepared than anybody else, particularly the question, most of them have some idea what they want done with their body, but what happens to us after we die? They stumbled on that one, although a few of them did have ghost stories themselves that they wanted to tell me off the record. They didn't want to be on the record indicating that they believed in ghosts in the embalming room, but they do.
Interesting, because I asked some people in anticipation of this interview at the dog park yesterday, and they were talking about how they changed their views about what happens. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is, you know, how much they're in touch with their spiritual side and the evolution of thought. It's very interesting, those two questions. Let me ask you in closing, why is it that I'm so fascinated these days with obituaries? It seems as if they really tell a life story. And I wonder whether the living are really getting better at collecting their own thoughts in anticipation of death, recognizing its inevitability, and wanting to tell their own story and doing it in so many ways, or directing what comes as a result of their death. And even though they're not going to be there, even though I think there was a Queen of England who feigned a death, or maybe it was a king, so he could see what people were saying about him. It's just a bad idea as a practice run. But how important is it that when you're alive, you begin to think about what was this really all about? What did I accomplish? What was it that I thought was really special and noteworthy? And try to memorialize that yourself and direct others as they are there in your stead.
Yeah, I think that's one of the kind of the positive existential reactions you can have, is to realize that you are making your own story, or you have that capacity while you're alive. After you're gone, you know, there's no more chapters that we know of, or that that the living will know about. You know, we also are seeing this movement not towards traditional funerals, memorials, but to celebrations of life. In the celebrations of life, it focuses on the good things about the person. People love it's a very positive thing to share stories, including funny stories about the individual, and that this is seen as a way to honor them in a better way than a very sad, somber funeral. Because in a way, a sad, somber funeral, and it focuses on the grief of the living. It might help them with that, to acknowledge how they're feeling. But if they're left at the end of that ritual with nothing but sad feelings and no happy memories to give them comfort, it's probably going to prolong the grief process. So this idea of telling a more rounded story of the individual for the celebration of life makes a lot of sense to me. Personally, I think that our orientation towards movies, to biographies, media stories, the storyline, even when I was making a documentary film, one of the things that dismayed me is that I was expected as a documentary filmmaker, if I was going to do it conventionally, to tell a single coherent story through the perspective of one person. And I'm existentialist enough to know that lives are not lived like coherent stories. If you're going to make it a coherent story from birth through death, with a peak plot, and that there's a through line and a consistent personality or character, what that means is you've erased a lot. Because most people's lives in reality are lived a bit chaotically. They reinvent themselves. They're, you know, different acts to their lives. And maybe it's more like a mixed up play or an improvisation. So I think there's an artificiality to trying to make our lives read like a coherent story. The celebration I like better than an obituary, because everyone shares their memories, and they can be from different phases of that person's life. They can be different facets of their life in different tones. It's more the kind of crazy collage that really is our life.
It's very interesting you say that, because I just did a memoir, a career reflection, and there was nothing planned about what I ended up doing, and it was random, chaotic, and as I said, always in a place I didn't think I belonged, and that was the most exciting part of the entire journey. Well, Shannon Lee Dotty, I've got to thank you. What a wonderful book, American Afterlives. And it's as thoughtful as you could hear her being today on our podcast, Reinventing Death in the 21st Century. What about the documentary, I Like Dirt, and of course, Daniel Zox, your partner? Where can that be seen?
If you go to my author page, Shannon Lee Dotty, or the film page, I Like Dirt with a period, ilikedirtfilm.com. There's a link to the Patreon site to support Daniel's nonprofit filmmaking.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I really do appreciate it, on America Trends.
Okay. Thank you, Larry.